Okay, this is session 39, recorded on May 14th, 2007. This is side one, and we're continuing in the croaker section of my book. And we're going to take a sample from the Panic Encyclopedia, which came out in 1989, written by Arthur Croaker, his wife Mary Louise Croaker, and David Cook. And from page 261 and page 262, we have a sample category in my book called Panic Zombies. In this Panic Encyclopedia, Croaker listed all kinds of things from A to Z and put the word panic in front of them. Like he had one section on Panic Gorbachev. That was Gorbachev before the wall went down. So we're doing now Panic Zombies, and in brackets, Carson and Letterman, the talk show guys. So Scott's going to read this section.
Okay, here we go. Panic Zombies, in brackets, Carson and Letterman. So that sentence is italicized. If advertisements are the truth-sayers of the TV programs, which are their media vehicles, then Alpo Dog Food names Johnny Carson Show correctly. The Johnny Carson Show correctly. Johnny and Ed are America's favorite pets. The show occurs between prime time and sleepy time, with all of the nocturnal pleasure of a regular bowel movement. The Carson Show is, anyway, a real panic scene. Not, however, panic of the frenzied type, but the reverse, panic inertia, an unchanging format for a static submass, which has disappeared into the white suburban Bantus, that's capital B-A-N-T-U-S.
Bantus, like in South Africa. The concentration camps are reservations for the local blacks. Under apartheid, I think.
Oh, okay. Disappeared into the white suburban Bantus and taken to Carson as its nightly excremental habit. As Carson likes to insist, it's just entertainment. He's the parasite, the audience, the bored voyeur, and the guests, changing particles in promotional culture. And David Letterman? He is the Johnny Carson of the Reagan youth generation. A little cynicism, a little humor for a generation that has the American political philosopher.
No, that, the, a little cynicism, a little humor for a generation that the American political philosopher Michael Weinstein
has described as distinguished by a, quote, strong sense of self, but a weak ego, unquote. As a graduate of Ball State University in the middle of Indiana, Letterman has moved his Hoosier, that's capital H, personality from the regions into the center of New York media culture. With Letterman, the dinner party runs its course from hospitality to hostility to the hospital. Letterman is, in fact, the perfect predator of his audience. In brackets, his popularity rests with denigrating the audience. Of his guests, in brackets, it says the celebrities are brought out as living targets. Of himself, in brackets, as supposedly unlikely talk show host. And of TV, in brackets, Tonight with David Letterman, that's in bold print, parodies the medium of talk shows. While the secret of Johnny Carson's success is as a cultural parasite, Letterman is a media predator. Here, America at Night finds its final destiny as a Hoosier predator, alternating between envy and resentment.
And Hoosier, I think, is the name of the sports reality in at the University of, or in the state of Indiana, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's like a middle America personality.
Yeah, I was surprised because I thought that was a Canadian term.
No, that's Hosers.
Oh, okay.
H-O-S.
Yeah.
Two O's.
Yeah.
So he says here the guests are changing particles. You can see in my chart I have each quadrant as a subatomic particle. But the changing particles is an important metaphor from science and pointing out Coker following from Baudrillard. Baudrillard sort of laid out the pattern of describing, of saying that the scientific categories of postmodern or modern physics and science are actually sociological descriptions of the effects of media. And the content on late 80s media is rapidly disappears and is transient like changing particles. So that's a continuation there of that theme. So you got not frenzied type of panic, it's panic inertia. So he's got, Coker talks about us being predators and parasites, so he's divided it up. So Carson is, represents the older generation of parasites, and the younger aggressive generation are predators, therefore they have Letterman.
Well, he says Carson is, where does he say it here? He says Carson is the predator and the parasite and the, I'm not finding it right here.
You mean in this section we just read?
Yeah. He says, Carson, just entertainment. Oh, yeah, he's the parasite, the audience, the board voyeur, and the guest.
Okay, Carson licenses it's just entertainment. He's the parasite, the audience, the board voyeur, and the guests, but he's not a predator there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, how does he get to be all four?
All, what are the
Well,
four?
In what sense is he the parasite?
Nothing. He doesn't abuse his guests. Letterman of the later cynical Generation X, even though he's a boomer, but he's speaking to the media-saturated culture where people are in different rivulets of experience and the content, the stars, are meant just to be abused.
Mm-hmm.
So he abuses them. He abuses his audience. He predates on his audience, his guests, and himself, and TV.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd say Johnny Carson is more of the 1560s when TV was ground. When the satellite and the digital Android meme takes over, eats up the old TV ground. So that's what Letterman represents. He's parodying. He's a predator of TV itself. Whereas Carson, being an older generation, he still lives in the mass media passive atmosphere of television and allows people to come on and innocently promote their stuff.
Right.
Whereas Letterman's more cynical, a whole later generation of watching endless TV promotion. He makes fun of the people coming on to promote their gigs.
Yeah. And why do people come on and put up with that, you know? Because they want to promote their book or because they get that part of the joke or something?
Well, there's that, but there's the fact that no one ever turned off the media environment because it was an extension of our senses. Therefore, we had 24/7. Yet the average mind is bored with this, but it can't be turned off. So,
I'm just trying to think of the celebrity. Wouldn't he rather go
no,
on?
No, I'm bringing that up. So then the celebrity has to produce books, movies, and all this content for the media machine. They know it's just business as usual, so there's no big deal. So they're indifferent to being abused because they need to go on there and get their plug in.
Yeah.
They got to show up and work.
Plus it gives them a chance to show off how witty they are, and, you know, they can...
Yeah, that's true on Carson. The thing is that it's a job.
Yeah.
And it comes with the job, and even the irony is anemic or weak because... It doesn't cancel out anything.
Yeah.
The media keep going. The shows carry on.
Yeah. Well, Carson Letterman's also an effect of that thing he used to talk about, where the kids would just look dumb as a way of put on.
That's in any environment to the so-called information environment.
Yeah.
Being indifferent. Indifferent to information, knowledge, data intake.
Right, that's an attitude that Letterman sort of...
Yeah, he that's why he's a boomer, but he feeds off the attitude of the later generations, or he mirrors it back to them.
Yeah.
The cynicism of Generation X.
Yeah.
Says a little cynicism, a little humor for a generation that Michael Weinstein has described as distinguished by, and this is the Reagan youth generation, or Generation X, distinguished by, quote, a strong sense of self, but a weak ego.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be a weak industrial visual space in McLuhan terms, ego, but a strong sense of entitlement to all this media. Serve it up to me.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have to serve it up to me because I need it, because it's part of my body.
But Carson also played off the weak ego thing. He played the kind of slightly pathetic guy that everyone could sort of feel a little better than. And
yeah, he, in a way, I mean, I remember McLuhan used to really put down Carson, said, what an idiot. But, you know, for the hard industrial ego of the 40s and 50s, a guy like Carson looked pretty bland in the 60s. But as the culture got massaged by the mixed corporate media and everybody's ego got weakened, he actually became a resonant figure by the 80s.
Yeah.
He already had a weak ego and a strong sense of self. He was ahead of his time for his generation.
Yeah. When Carson and Letterman were both on at the same time, I'll bet Letterman never actually took the lion's share of the market away from Carson.
Yeah.
Now, Leno's kind of a dweeb. I don't know what his deal is, but he's kind of trying to prop up the Carson tradition in his anemic way.
Right. So, there's a point there. So Carson, I meant he was resonant. He was ahead of his time in terms of resonant. His image merged with the mood that was being massaged by the global theater media.
Right.
And
you know, the thing about Leno,
that's not offering any environment.
The thing about Leno is that, you know, he goes on year after year after year, so he apparently meets the need, but he doesn't appear to resonate with anything. He's got no charisma. He's got nothing. The guy shows, it's like watching a dead guy.
Well, I don't know if it's popular anymore.
Well, it's still on. It's obviously, if he wasn't bringing in the advertising dollars, they'd replace him.
Well, you're bringing in your point, your own.
I'm just saying.
Point.
I'm wondering if you even need to be if being resonant with the audiences or the media environment is obsolete.
No, if you've been around long enough, you're part of people's lives when you were resonant, and then you become a familiar, like he says about Johnny Carson, the nocturnal pleasure of a regular bowel movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's an nightly excremental habit. So looking at Letterman is a habit for those that enjoyed his show. And
excremental in what sense? I know Croker talks about excremental TV, but I don't really know what he means by that.
Excremental means a bowel movement.
Well,
feces.
Well, what are you purging when you watch Carson? I mean, why is that an excremental?
Well, it's multi-leveled. You had all your daily experiences, and then you you have to remove them.
Right.
You have to process them or let it come through. So looking at Carson in a way, maybe even more so Letterman, since you're going to watch him abuse people, you're kind of watching him shit on everybody, and that's your form of TV body, extramental turds.
Right.
You participate in the process, so you let go for the day.
Yeah. Of course, Howard Stern did that for the morning radio drive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, the abuse factor, you know, intensified in the 90s in all kinds of media, like Jerry Springer.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say Anna Nicole Smith was someone who celebrated herself being abused. That was the extreme end of the trajectory of TV body abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are probably, older people watch Carson, that lasted for many years. Then Letterman now is an old guy, and the young kids don't even watch TV, apparently, so they watch that Stewart guy, John Stewart, The Daily Show. But they're more media consumptive or savvy, so they want to watch information that's supposedly news or relevant, so they can't take regular news. It's a post-information environment, so they look at a put-on news. But that's news rather than looking at product endorsements or whatever people come on to plug on Letterman. So, yeah, Letterman's probably not as... I mean, you're speaking from your point of view, your personal point of view of what he is.
Yeah.
But that's irrelevant. He's still on there, so he must have some kind of...
Well, I was referring to Leno when I was saying I don't know why he's, you know, still on. Not Letterman. I was referring to Jay Leno.
Right. And Letterman, you can see he's still on.
Yeah, you know, he's, you know, he's still kind of like you say, he just sort of, you know, people are used to him, so they tune in for nostalgia's sake or whatever. And he's got his little bit of a update on, like you say, on the Carson era. But it's Leno who took over for Carson. The guy's got nothing going on upstairs, and he's got no charisma. He doesn't resonate to anything that I can see. But, you know, he still does his show every night, and he gets his lion's share of the advertising dollars, or he wouldn't be on.
Right, so you would want to understand what his appeal is, not worry about your opinion of it.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a combination of Letterman and Carson, and more on the Carson side.
Yeah. No, he doesn't do the letter. He doesn't try to be cynical like Letterman.
Hmm. But, well, I never watch any of these guys. I don't know anything about them.
Yeah, oh, okay. Well, you must have seen them. I mean, you flipped
through
the dials.
Yeah, once or twice.
Yeah. So, you know, starts out here, he's talking about panic zombies, Carson and Letterman. He's got them in the zombie category. Panic. I don't know why panic, because if it's like the pleasure of a regular bowel movement and a relaxing sort of purging of, why, you know, I don't know what the panic is all about.
The panic is they got to show up every night and keep doing it.
Oh, yeah.
He calls it panic inertia.
No. Carson presumably liked showing up and doing his show. It was fun for him. He got to have these great intercourse with all the big names on the planet every night.
Yeah, he's a zombie talking to the other zombies, and it's not explained what.
Well, everybody on the planet's not a zombie. I mean, you know.
No, but in Celebrity Land, you are. You have to be a zombie to be a
celebrity. He didn't just have celebrities. He had scientists, doctors.
No, they're zombies too. Anybody who's on TV is a zombie because they just come on and merge with the environment. They don't offer any anti-environment. You're only going to get that from...
So you're not making a personal assessment of these people if you met them on the street. You're just saying that's what they are on the air.
Yeah, they're very different on the air than they are in private life.
Yeah.
They merge with the corporate mandate there, the mandate of representing what they're known for and not offering any real interesting twist on it. Even if they're known like a Ralph Nader, he'll go on and be an ordinary Ralph Nader. He's known to be a critic of the military industrial complex, but he'll just be that.
Mm-hmm.
You're stigmatized in that medium, so in that sense you're a zombie. Mm. But largely, they think that other than making money, they think getting their information, they're on there to make money, but if they think that there's a message going out, that's a real lack of awareness. A message going out that's going to accomplish what they claim is the good parts of what they're offering.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep the information environment going as zombies. Mm-hmm. And they're always in a panic state in the sense that it's a live show and there's always that little nervousness about what might happen on the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe, will they be upstaged by their guest?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what people like. That's the abuse factor that people tune into. They're fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm.
All this is natural human nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, he doesn't say why they're zombies in particular.
Yeah.
Just other than it's a nightly ritual.
Yeah. And it's panic because you got to keep the network going.
Yeah.
Now, I can just imagine behind the scenes a lot of people scrambling to get the show started on time and, you know, under budget and all that kind of stuff that goes on behind the scenes and people getting fired and all that. But anyway, so he says, but he makes this presumption at the beginning. He says here, if advertisements are the truth-sayers of TV programs, so why does he presume advertisements are truth-sayers of anything?
It's a ratio here. The TV program is the media vehicle for the advertisement. And advertisements actually are the truth sayers in the sense that they're the real reason you get to see a program. If it wasn't for the advertisements in American capitalist culture, you wouldn't have a program because they pay the bill.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's all for money, that this information is not to inform but to keep the profit cycle going, then that's how advertisements are symbolically truth-sayers of the TV programs. But he means it in the sense that the ads resonate with the theme. So Johnny Carson, his Apple dog food is the main advertiser, I guess, and that's what he is. He's one of America's favorite pets.
Yeah.
So it's like when I say advertisements are manipulating satire of the news.
Mm-hmm.
So news is new live programming. Advertisements do a satire on it with their metaphorical, you can look at them as metaphorical commentary on the show. So the ads here, he may mean they're manipulating satirists, that sense of truth-sayer of the TV program.
Mm-hmm.
Not just on the simple capitalist point.
Right.
There's underlying synchrony or synchronicity going on between the ads and the program that the ads are supporting. The
right.
type of ads match with the program. As we tell more about the program. For example, Alpo dog food. That's what Johnny Carson is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I remember correctly, he used to do the Alpo ads himself. Rather than cutting to a commercial, he'd hold up the can of dog food and tell everybody to treat their pet to this wonderful food. But I don't know if I'm remembering that right. It seems like he used to do some of his own commercials.
But again,
here's actually the answer to my question. I was saying, why is Carson considered panic when he's so laid back? And there's actually right here in the next paragraph, he says, the Carson show is anyway a real panic scene, not, however, the panic of the frenzied type, but reverse panic inertia.
Yeah, in other words, maintaining the old stereotypes, an unchanging format.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the role of Reagan as president. He had to remind people that there was an America once.
Yeah, right. Unchanging format for a static submass. Yeah, people want
subatomic. That's the subatomic particles again.
Yeah, people want routine in their life. It makes them feel comfortable. Makes them know what to expect, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, without lowers the anxiety level. So, I suppose Carson did that for people.
Yeah, and it's a kind of medicine. It's a kind of anesthetic, and that's a useful function. Since people are living in such anxiety, and as you move into the chip zone, the digital zone of the 80s and 90s, life became pretty unstable in America.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
he offered something familiar, so that is not a useless function.
Yeah.
Considering the larger environment of panic going on.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is. So he's a panic. In the panic environment, they offer familiarity or zombiness. They're there to be repeated.
Mm-hmm. An unchanging format for a static submass which has disappeared into the white suburban Bantus.
Yeah, Bantus is a loaded term because it's like a concentration camp.
Hmm.
So the chemical body is in a concentration camp.
Right. Yeah.
And the TV body, has a bowel movement, but it's not through the chemical body bowel movement. It's just the whole process of observing what Carson does. That's the TV body's a bowel movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excremental habit.
What was that movie that Oliver Stone did in the 90s? Wild at Heart.
Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, that was probably a 20 years later, actually doing a a satire on the scene, comparable to what Croker's saying right now about what was happening. Croker saw it when it was actually happening, and then Stone does a movie about it 20 years later.
No, only 3 years later. That movie was in the before 95.
Uh huh. Oh, that's right.
In the early 90s.
Right. But Croker's talking about a period here, probably in the. Well, it probably dates back.
Late 80s.
Yeah.
3-4 years before the movie.
Yeah.
So they actually come out of the same period.
Yeah, okay. So maybe Stone
was. So your point is, though, if it was 20 years down the road, or what was your point?
Well, no, I guess then we could say Oliver Stone was sort of tuned into the Croker vibe when he made that movie, because that movie kind of reflects what Croker's talking about here.
Right. So.
But I was thinking, you know, that, you know, when Croker wrote this, Carson had already been on for 30 years, at least.
Yeah.
Almost 30 years, since yeah. 62 or something.
Yeah.
63, 64, somewhere's in there, yeah.
So.
But, so 25 years anyways. So the thing is that you have Croker here making patterns out of pop culture like McLuhan did.
Mm-hmm.
And Thompson did a little bit. And LaRouche doesn't do the pop culture scene like this. Doesn't go into details.
Mm-hmm.
And so Croker is trying to show the zeitgeist and show how these different things resonate off each other. And if Natural Born Killers came out a little later, he would have fit that in if he had a chance to comment on to the same mood that creates the panic zombies.
Mm-hmm.
It's all dealing with the underlying ground, like McLuhan points out, of panic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not strange that a movie would come out, or a critic like Croker would come out, or other syndromes of culture and entertainment in the late 80s all comes from the same zeitgeist, and McLuhan would try to point out what was the ground, what was the material cause of that zeitgeist, and find the characteristics of the material environment and show how it resonated in the public.
Yeah.
What Croker is talking about is the disappeared state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Disappearance not only of the chemical body, but of the TV body. So that Carson represents the TV body unselfconscious, whereas Letterman is the TV body self-conscious.
Well, we said the bodies don't really come in until the 90s.
Right. No, but the... Yeah, we should say the end of the TV landscape as we move into the chip landscape. Yeah, you're right. Bodies are more than 90. So in the late 80s, the TV landscape has to be propped up by a zombie like Carson because to get comfort for people nervous, panicked by the digital landscape. And then Letterman's image is a little later showing the digital landscape x-raying the older TV landscape and abusing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So in my terms, I fit Johnny and Letterman in a different level. I agree with his Croker's assessment of them, but we could see a more narrative, progressive situation happening here if you line up the different landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So Letterman is more resonating with the digital landscape.
Mm-hmm. And
I like his description of Letterman. He says he alternates between envy and resentment. See, that would be in the digital landscape because people believe the media world. The TV landscape, when it came in the 50s and 60s, was a whole new environment and was celebrated. Then by the 80s, it just gone on so long, plus its stereotypes and truths were weakened by the new digital landscape. So you have a lot more resentment about the TV landscape in the digital era, and you have a lot of envy.
Mm-hmm.
So a combination of envy and resentment. That may have been true in the TV landscape, but it was not as obvious as a public mood.
Mm-hmm.
But it can become a mood under Letterman conditions because it's a later phase. I mean, that's basically what talk radio and they say American culture has been an angry culture for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
With envy and resentment, People Magazine gossip exaggeration.
Mm-hmm. With Letterman, the dinner party runs its course from hospitality to hostility to the hospital.
Yeah, you abuse them and take them there. Send them to the hospital.
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, so let's go on to the next quote.
Okay.
And this is interesting. It is from Croker's journal. Academic journal of that period in the late 80s called the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory. That became a website in the 90s called C Theory. C for, I don't know, Crash, I think it is. Crash Theory, which was a 90s term and theme that Croker developed after my book came out. So the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory, a journal that Croker ran, featured an article called On the Rise and Decline of Totalitarian Liberalism, subtitled Schlesinger, Bell, and LaRouche. So I needed this because I want to have a dialogue between the four guys, McLuhan, Croker, LaRouche, and Thompson. So I had to find something where Croker writes on LaRouche, and fortunately there did exist something. Now, it wasn't written by him, but it's sponsored by Croker and put in his journal.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from an article by someone named Larry Portis in the fall of 1988, volume 12, number 3 of the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory, and it's page 34, and you want to read it?
Yeah. What is generally taken as, quote, extremism, unquote, in the U.S., is the opposite of the collective state of political apathy that is maintained by those in positions of power. There are two ways of understanding the phenomena. First, the relative quiescence and political ignorance of the American population represents an opportunity, a field of action for, quote, activists, unquote. A lack of political consciousness is fertile ground for manipulation based upon the most exaggerated claims. In this sense, apathy tends to encourage, quote, extremism, unquote. Second, the presence of, quote, extremists, unquote, works to the benefit of those in positions of power and authority who are quick to explain that any deviation from the political orthodoxy of the moment will degenerate into, quote, irrationality, unquote, and violence. Social criticism is thus a sign of irresponsibility. In other words, the myth of, quote, consensus, unquote, implies the creation of scapegoats. Over the past 20 years, individuals like Joseph McCarthy, Lyndon LaRouche, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, etc., have succeeded in imposing themselves upon the public by profiting from the civil apathy and political ignorance of the North American population through the process of scapegoating. Products of the myth of, quote, consensus, unquote, these men have also contributed to its destruction.
So, you got anything to say about that?
Well, like, for instance, in the first sentence, it was generally taken as, quote, extremism, unquote. Why is he quoting the word extremism?
Because
he's saying it's not really extremism?
Yeah, it actually fits in.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the collective state of political apathy. So he's saying the state of collective political apathy then generates its polar opposite.
And which is necessary to add validity to the consensus.
Yeah,
it
okay.
says, the presence of extremists works to the benefit of those in positions of power and authority who are quick to explain that any deviation from the political orthodoxy of the moment will degenerate into irrationality and violence. Social criticism is thus a sign of irresponsibility. So the political authorities are so nervous in maintaining consensus that they need someone to criticize to give them a sense of their role and
mm-hmm.
their purpose. This is the Foucault idea that power, Foucault recommended that students, whatever, not protest those in power because you're giving reality to those in power. They already are in a very feeble situation, those
mm-hmm.
in power, and to give them something to do and point at and scapegoat.
Yeah.
Reinforces those images of consensus that the authorities hope to create.
Hmm. So the idea is if you leave them alone, they'll crumble on their own, under the weight of their own inertia. But if you feed them energy, they can keep playing off of that.
Yeah. So these aren't really extremists. They are part of the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph McCarthy, LaRouche, Nixon, Reagan. They've succeeded in imposing themselves upon the public by profiting from the civil apathy and political ignorance of the North American population through the process of scapegoating.
Yeah.
So, and it's interesting, LaRouche never was president. Nixon and Reagan were. McCarthy was a senator. So you have a range here of people. Like Reagan, let's look at this. Joseph McCarthy really stirred up the pot and had a real effect on people. LaRouche comes in. He's marginal, but he's part of the counterculture of the late 60s and early 70s. And then Nixon. And the authorities, they had to make the president become the scapegoater.
Mm-hmm.
That's how desperate it was. Whereas McCarthy and LaRouche were not presidents.
No, but, well, LaRouche was scapegoated. McCarthy was an asshole.
Well, that's what I mean. It was more
real. He wasn't scapegoated. He was actually a villain.
Yeah, well, it was constitutive back then in the 50s.
Yeah.
And so it almost, the consensus didn't need someone like him. He was just reacting to the communist effect of television, you know, mm-hmm. rearview mirror projection on it, the collectivity that TV was bringing in the beginning of the TV landscape. LaRouche comes out of the counterculture, and Nixon and Reagan, they're more getting layers of fantasy.
Yeah. Again, Nixon wasn't really scapegoated. He was busted.
Yeah, but he did scapegoat. He had the blacklist of all those people that he was...
Oh, I see, yeah. And that's, you know, yeah, in that sense, same thing with McCarthy. He was scapegoating off of other people. He wasn't used as a scapegoat. He was using others as scapegoats.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But what LaRouche is a fringe scapegoater.
Yeah, he wants to blame the British.
Right, and he also blames the White House. So
mm-hmm.
McCarthy is blaming communists. Then there's no communists in the counterculture period. So LaRouche blames the White House cabinet, the people around the president. He tended not to blame the president,
mm-hmm.
but he blamed the controllers around him. Then, so he's scapegoating the established consensus maker. But then the consensus maker by the time of Nixon and later Reagan, the consensus itself in a decentralized society, to speak in McClune's terms, and a more disappearing of the whole political raison d'etre, then the White House has to become a scapegoater to create a reality for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the McCarthy and LaRouche period, the White House was still solid.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, Nixon, he ends up getting scapegoated himself. But so does Reagan, because he has rank-contra, but
busted.
Not as extreme as Nixon.
Yeah, well, got busted. I don't know if they got scapegoated.
Who,
busted.
Nixon?
Yeah.
Well, he was a scapegoat for larger problems. The military-industrial complex... was embarrassed by Vietnam, so they had to blame someone.
Yeah.
You could say he brought it on himself, but there was no hesitation in going after him.
Right.
In terms of protecting the charisma of the White House. But every president since Kennedy has been nailed, even Eisenhower. That's the interesting thing, that the White House is an image of consensus, but it also has to scapegoat and also is subject to abuse value, all in the same complex.
Right. Well, sometimes when, you know, like something just takes over the entire media, like Anna Nicole Smith for 6 weeks, you know, people go around saying, yeah, well, what's the government doing behind the scenes now that they got Anna Nicole Smith running cover for them in order to take the heat off of them?
Well, that's a later cynicism, postmodern cynicism, where people don't even consider a worthwhile enterprise coming out of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That they assume something is always being covered up. It's like... they're covering up their own inadequacy,
mm-hmm.
and it's in a more extreme later phase.
Mm-hmm.
So then they promote an Anna Nicole Smith, and we think, oh, there's something going on behind the scenes. And that gives a reality to the government and its ability to Machiavellian-wise, like Machiavelli, make as if they're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So conspiracy views of the White House have increased in the 90s, this decade, and the White House probably promotes that because
mm-hmm.
makes us believe that they're doing something. You follow?
Yeah.
It's another form of creating a viability to their authority.
Mm-hmm.
And then LaRouche is a conspiracy theorist. He's still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So when the average citizen says, what's the government doing behind the scenes? If it wasn't for Anna Nicole Smith, they wouldn't think of the government.
Mm-hmm.
So Anna Nicole Smith helps them think there is a government. So the government set it up and murdered Anna Nicole Smith to create that distraction so that they could seem like a viable entity.
Right. People
capable of conspiring.
Right. People might think that. We can't say that anything like that happened. But people might think that. That the government killed Anna Nicole Smith.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Now, some people say that. There were a lot of people on the Internet saying that.
Oh,
not that the government, but that she was murdered. But maybe it wasn't the government, right?
Yeah.
Let's try to be extreme. Let's be more extreme than the extremists. Build up the credibility of the government by saying that they're capable of killing somebody like Anna Nicole Smith and getting away with it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about the Bush administration is it has sort of in a way shown in all the crises and panic situations that it supposedly got itself into, it showed itself not really capable of doing anything, so it sort of doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You have a Katrina disaster and no government shows up.
Yeah.
Only privatized mercenary groups.
Right. Well, whether it's an illusion or not, I suppose you could debate forever, but there seems to be a causal effect between the White House and the war in Iraq.
Well, that's something that they can't do anything about and supposedly botched.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't show up correctly for that either.
Yeah.
They don't even fund the soldiers, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't fund the injured soldiers. They got no money.
Well, I heard they were borrowing money from China to pay for the war, so the money was coming in.
Right, but it's probably used for other things. But they certainly, they ain't supplying enough to the soldiers.
Well, yeah, people say that. We don't know to what degree they are or are not, but you could always say that it could be better. They could be doing a better job. There's no end to that.
But if there's no government, really, no organized way there was a government 30, 40 years ago, then that explains why they are anemic, because they have no ground to work in. And so being incompetent is the last gasp of this pattern we're talking about in this quote here. The last gasp is to appear to be incompetent. That makes people think you still exist.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be hard for people to really believe that there was no government. But if you look into it...
Well, are we at the end of the road, or is this going to flip into something else in 2008?
Oh, yeah, we're at the end of the road. We're at the end of the road in 2000, so we never had a government. And the image of the government for the old medium of TV, but it couldn't do anything in any traditional sense of government wisdom or government efficiency, and that's because there never was anything except China since 2000.
And if all the media have emerged, then you can't really rely on tetrad management anymore. You can't say it's going to flip into its opposite at some point.
Yeah, and the Android meme, which did pentad management, the Android meme's gone. So we're in chaos.
Hmm.
Blatant Paleolithic chaos.
Paleolithic or Neolithic?
Paleolithic, caveman, pre-agricultural. And the Paleolithics were hunters.
Yeah.
We're in an information-hunting world, and more there's no information to find. Hmm. Other than that information, that pattern.
Yeah. Well, individuals run down information for personal gain and exploitation and so on, but... Maybe in the larger sense, there's no...
Well, that's the ongoing media environments.
Yeah.
You see, they exist, but they don't have any constituent power. So there's lots of room for all kinds of information.
Well, define the word constituent here. I mean, I know what it means, but say a little more about that they don't have any constituent power.
They are not the oxygen that you're breathing that sustains life.
Yeah.
The oxygen that sustains life is the present, what we call ground. And that ground is an effect of all the digital media interpenetrating and canceling itself out.
Mm-hmm.
So the void is the constituent factor now.
Yeah. And when we get to cold fusion, then...
Well, there's your flip.
Then we'll be post-void.
Yeah, we flip out of the software void into a new hardware.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the tetrad can be applied.
But that'll decentralize things even further when everybody has their own energy supply. That's maximum decentralization.
Right, but you're not in a panic state of having to pay rent.
Yeah.
But, you know, humans, different cultures may adapt to it differently.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about America is that it won't get cold fusion. It'll be the last place to get it because it can't adapt to such a radical new energy device.
Mm-hmm.
So America will be the last to get cold fusion.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I can see what you're saying. On the other hand, it's kind of like when TV started to invade the Soviet Union, everybody saw that, oh, everybody's got TVs. We want TVs, too. I would think that would happen with the American public. Well, people are getting cold fusion. We're the, you know, King Kong of the world. We want it, too.
Yeah, but we might be under martial law by then.
Well, hopefully Marshall McLuhan law.
Yeah, right. Well, Marshall McLuhan law predicts drastic effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Only because people didn't realize how drastic the new environment and its effects were.
Mm-hmm.
There's the cultural adjustment to these situations, which brings in extreme behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So what... So that's an interesting quote. It was good to find this is what